yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, so this is the weekend they call Labor Day weekend. And let's take an assessment of what's happening to labor over the past year and since the last recession. Gives you a good indication of where things are going for the working class and those that they call the middle class that are really the working class, too. So let's take stock of the status and condition of labor today, sort of a labor balance sheet. And, of course, we can look at jobs, which are extremely important as far as labor's condition is concerned, but not just jobs in terms of absolute numbers. You know, what's important about jobs is income. Right? You can have job creation and little or no net income creation, and that's been the problem. Yes, we've added jobs here, although we'll look at today's labor report, a little bit of a warning. But these jobs have been low-quality jobs, meaning they don't pay a hell of a lot. They're mostly service jobs, and not just service jobs, but part-time and temp and contract and low-pay gig and trends like students working for nothing more and more just to get to be seen by prospective employers and employers manipulating that. Okay, so jobs are an important indicator of the condition of labor today. Wages, of course, just as important. Not nominal wages, you know, what you actually get paid per hour or per week, but adjusted for inflation, what you can really buy with it. That's what's important. And then, of course, there are non-wage compensation benefits like pensions, health care, employer-provided health care, and other benefits related to work. Compensation benefits of various kind. That's part of your income as well. What about taxes? Yeah, we have to take into consideration taxes because if the workers, working class, is paying a greater share as those on capital incomes, in other words, those earning dividends, interest, rents, and so forth, are paying less and less a share, and their corporations who pass through those capital incomes in form of dividend and stock buybacks and so forth to them are paying less and less. Well, somebody has to be paying more, and, of course, that's the working class. Then we can look at their unions, organizational question. You know, how have the unions been faring, and what does the scenario look like going forward here for organized labor, union labor in the U.S.? And then on the political side, too, what's the political influence of the working class here through the two parties? Okay, so there's lots of ways of assessing the condition. Let's start with jobs. Okay, we've heard a lot of hype over recent years on how the unemployment rate is down to 4.4%. It was well over 10%, and now it's down to 4.4%. Well, that's called the U3 unemployment rate from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that's full-time employees, you see. That's not part-time. That's full-time. And the ranks of the full-time have not grown hardly at all since the last recession. Where the growth has come, it's been in part-time and temp, which is often part-time as well. especially even if it's full-time temp workers, they have big gaps of no work in between getting on temporarily. So they're really part-time. You see, temp workers are really part-time workers. Maybe not part-time per hour, but part-time over the course of the year. Well, there's what's called the U6 unemployment rate, and that includes part-time workers, both voluntary and involuntary. Now, the government, U.S. government, is very clever on how it calculates and miscalculates employment and unemployment, make it look unemployment's not as serious as it actually is, and employment is greater than it actually is. And how do they do that? Well, to be unemployed, you've got to be out of work and looking for a job in the past 4 weeks. If you are out of work and haven't looked in the past 4 weeks, well, you're not part of the U3 official unemployment rate. You may not have a job, which is the best definition of unemployment, but as far as the government's concerned, you're not unemployed. Well, what if you looked prior to the 4 weeks? You know, you just sort of gave up looking the last 4 weeks. Well, then the government dumps you in a category called discouraged or missing labor force category. They count you there as discouraged or missing. But those numbers are grossly underestimated. You know, they estimate only 450,000 discouraged workers. In other words, you gave up looking between 4 weeks and 1 year, missing. If you've given up in the past year, you haven't looked in the past year. That group is only 1.5 million, that latter group, missing. Discouraged is like, well, a little short of 1 million, a half million rather. So that's about 2 million at most. But you know what? That number has not changed in 15 years, roughly. Now, come on. When you have a labor force growing by millions and population growing by millions, that number as a percent should be adjusted as well, but it's not. I'm very, very dubious of those discouraged and missing labor force numbers. I believe they are much higher. The government counts part-time workers if they're involuntary part-time. In other words, you're forced to work part-time for economic reasons, not by choice. That's 5.2 million in the latest report. Voluntary is like 22 million. And again, those numbers haven't changed, particularly voluntary, very much, even though the population and labor force has grown. And even though we have this phenomenon of gig work and other temporary and part-time work, it's not reflected at all in those part-time numbers. And the voluntary, I think, are really, there's a good percentage of those who are actually involuntary, but they don't want to indicate that they haven't been able to get something more than part-time. You know, a little embarrassed maybe, and all they can get is part-time, and they say, well, that's my choice, you know. There's a small percentage of that really should be involuntarily. Okay. Another gross underestimate is temporary workers. You see, the government only counts those that are temps according to agencies, you know, temporary hire agencies. But there's a lot of temp workers out there who don't go through agencies, independent contractors, people on call, and all kinds of other conditions where people are really working part-time. You know, middle managers get laid off in downsizing by corporations, and they hang up a shingle and they say, oh, I'm a consultant, right, and I'm working full-time. Yeah, no. Sometimes they even go back to work part-time or on contracts to their ex-employers. This happens a lot with professionals, you see. So the temps are much, much larger, you know, at least double the indication, the numbers of them. Back in the 1990s, this problem was getting so serious, the government did some studies under the Clinton administration trying to estimate the true number of temps, you see, because this is really, the temp phenomenon is really a creation of neoliberalism here, labor market restructuring since the 1980s. Before Reagan, you know, there weren't anything near what we call temps. And all the part-timers were pretty much voluntary. There wasn't involuntary part-time. This is one of the big changes in neoliberalism and how they've driven down wages by changing the labor markets. You know, the big change, of course, moving jobs offshore. That's a big change in labor markets. Another change in labor markets was deunionization, which has an impact on wages. Another, of course, is the creation of a service economy and part-time, involuntary part-time and temps and so forth. These all go together. And, of course, this revolution, capitalist revolution in labor markets continues to this day with the creation, you know, the phenomenon of the gig workers and this new indentureship where, you know, young people coming, millennials coming into the labor force have to work for nothing. And the employers and the tech companies are notorious for this. They hire people just to see how well they can do for 6 months, and, you know, with the promise of after 6 months working for nothing, if they like you, they'll hire you full-time. Well, a lot of these smaller tech companies super exploit this. They just keep turning people over after 6 months, right? Other ways they exploit ideas of young workers, too, is they create these coding academies. Maybe you've heard of that. Oh, you're going to learn to do software coding. Everyone thinks there's a hell of a lot of jobs in software coding. No. Kids go and they pay for that. And the employers send representatives to these coding academies to see who's sharp and who isn't. Maybe they hire a couple, but they steal the ideas from all, because you have to produce something and show it to prospective employers for them even to look at you. And they even do this online now. You know, it's not just going physically to a location called a coding academy. People in tech trying to get jobs put this stuff up online and so forth. It's free product ideas, and the employers just rip this stuff off because it's not copyrighted, and they use it and profit from it, and don't give anybody any credit from it. You know, this is really, they're really scavengers. The tech industry is really a scavenger. They're devastating labor markets the same way other companies in the past have abused labor markets. They're a big labor market abuser, I think. And people think tech is so great. Well, they're destroying jobs everywhere. And they're bringing in people from offshore, hundreds of thousands. I've talked about this before. You know, hiring these people from offshore, mostly from Asia. And what do they do? They don't hire or train people from the U.S. They used to train people in the U.S., tech companies, no longer. They just pull these people in because they're multinationals, and they pull them in from their operations offshore and bring them on. And evidence increasingly is that they bring them on less than they should be paying or would be paying skilled American workers if they were training them, you see. But they don't train them, and they use that as an excuse. We need more, what do they call that visa? I forget. It's L1, L2, H1Bs, H1Bs. We need more, right? 100,000 a year. Actually, it's double that. They are able to manipulate, and a lot of those people stay. And, well, that way you don't have to train. You just pull people in from offshore, see? Okay, so, you know, I can do a whole show on the tech companies and what's wrong with them in terms of the damages they're doing to the U.S. economy and the labor force. But we'll do that another day. Let's get back to jobs. Let's get back to jobs here. Well, the point I'm making is part-time and temp jobs, the numbers are grossly underestimated. And what's called the U6 unemployment rate, which attempts to estimate the part-time and discourage workers and missing labor force, is itself underestimated. In the last report, if you added all the underemployment, you see part-time and temp and contract and so forth, is if they're not working full time, they're considered underemployed and maybe a half job. If you added that, the U6 unemployment rate, not the U3, the U3 is full time, but all these other categories, which is where all the growth is in these other categories, U6 unemployment rate is 8.6% of the labor force. Okay. So 4.4% is, the full-time U3, and almost double that, 8.6%. Well, of what? 8.6% of what? Well, of the labor force, the civilian labor force. And how large is that? Well, that's 160 million and change here right now. But if that number is higher, if actually there are more part-time, discouraged, and so forth, and if you counted people not just as out of work for 4 weeks looking for work, the number would be much higher. It would be double digits for sure, more than 8.6%. Okay, so we have another problem here with the job picture. They just keep hyping this 4.4% full-time unemployment rate, but the real action is elsewhere in terms of problems with the job markets. All right, another one is labor force participation. That's, how many people are looking for work in the labor force. They may be employed or unemployed, but they're looking for work or working as a percentage of the population. Okay, 62.9% is the labor force participation rate in this country. Okay, so about 63% of people are working. Well, a decade ago in 2007, and we should look if we're going to compare today to that period in 2007 before we had the disruption of the 2008-09 Great Recession, right? So compare apples to apples. The labor force participation rate was 66%, not 62.9. So somewhere 3%, 3.1% of the population is not working. Well, if the population today is 320 million and 3% difference in the participation rate, that's over 9 million people aren't in the labor force who should be in the labor force. Where did they go? Well, they're either not working. The discouraged numbers are a lot greater than the 2 million that they say. Or maybe they are working, but they're not being counted. They may be part of the missing undocumented workforce, or the shadow economy, youth in urban environments working off the books, or small businesses not reporting, people that are working because they don't report. It's a survey. We'll talk about the problems with that survey. But you have this, this phenomenon of, where's 9.6 million people? If we had the participation rate today that we had, people in the economy that we had in 2007, there'd be 9.6 million more people. Instead of 160 million working, there'd be 170 million working. 160.5, 9.6, there'd be 170 million. Where have they gone? Well, a good part of them, vast majority of them, are clearly not working. But they're not reported, you see. They're not reported as part of the unemployed. They may not have a job, but, the U.S. does not define unemployment as not having a job. That's an oxymoron, isn't it? You should be unemployed if you don't have a job. No, no. They narrow the definition, you see, in order to underestimate it. There's another way they underestimate the jobs number, and that's called new business formation estimates. You see, the numbers they present, the totals in the Bureau of Labor Statistics the unemployment rate and all that, they're just statistics. They aren't the actual numbers. A statistic is a procedural manipulation on raw data. They aren't the raw data. It's not that we have 8.6% of 160 million, or 8.6 million, excuse me, out of work. It's not that that's the number. That's an estimation, and a lot of statistical manipulation of raw actual data is done, you know, seasonality and so forth, before you get the number that comes out, and it sounds like, oh, there's so many, you know, there's 8 million unemployed. No, no. That's a statistic. That's an estimation. And one of the problems in the process of estimation is this thing called new business formation. Well, how does that work? Well, every month, so many new businesses are created. Tens and hundreds of thousands sometimes. New business created. You know, people form a simple proprietorship. Well, it's pretty easy to do. You just go to your state government and, you know, you file a name report and so forth, and you're in business. You're a business person, right? You're not a corporation. That's more complicated. But you can be a hybrid called a limited liability corporation or an S corporation, et cetera. So there's lots of ways you can form a business pretty easy, pretty quickly. Well, and every month, tens of thousands of these businesses go out. They go belly up. They decline. So what is the net new business formation? Because the government, the BLS, assumes that for every new business created, a certain number of jobs are created. You know, at least one, right? Proprietor and others. And, you know, they have a formula for estimating how many new jobs are created for every new business and how many are lost for every new business. And you get net new business formation generates a certain number of jobs. Well, that's an estimate. That's a statistic, you see, that they then add to the raw data that they collect for jobs before they come up with the statistic of the number of employed, unemployed, unemployment rates, and so forth. The other problem is that this new business formation net number lags by 6 to 9 months. So what you're seeing in the number of jobs created this month, you know, and they estimated, I think, in the employment numbers here this morning, 156,000, I think the number was, of jobs created in the report, which, by the way, we'll get to is grossly under under the number they expected. That number that you get, 156,000, part of that is composed of net new business formation 9 months ago, which is itself an estimate of net new business formation 9 months ago. So there, what you're seeing in 156,000 reflects, well, this is August, what was happening last December or January. Now, there's problems with this net new business formation. And it's only one of many statistical manipulations on the raw data by which they come up with the numbers. Yeah. Okay, there's another problem here with the job numbers, and that is there's really two reports the government gets. One is a kind of a census, partial census from large employers, large companies, for 400,000 or so. They have to report how many people they hired and laid off and a whole bunch of other information about wages and so forth. But that's only 400,000 out of about 9 million companies in the U.S. A lot of the companies, well, the vast majority, are small. And you got to know, you know, what the numbers are for that 8.5 million in terms of jobs, not just the 400,000 big companies that report. So how do they do that? They survey. They call up workers and to get an idea of what the situation is with jobs and employment and unemployment in small and medium business. It's a phone survey. Okay, so you can structure a phone survey, you know, to be fairly accurate, but the labor markets are changing dramatically and fast in the U.S., and it's making these phone surveys really not all that reliable. They interview 50,000 to 60,000 a month, and this is called the population survey, you see, not the enterprise survey. There's two surveys that the government uses to estimate jobs. So 50,000 to 60,000 a month phone surveys, and that's how they get the U4, U5, and U6, you see. Now, there's problems with these phone surveys because they don't pick up itinerant workers, right? Itinerant workers, don't have a phone or a landline. Well, okay, so they got cell phones. Well, the government's trying to pick up more through cell phones, but that doesn't always work very well with itinerant workers. The big problem is it doesn't matter if you got cell phones or a landline. If you're undocumented, you're not going to answer any phone and talk to anybody in the government, right? And we had 11 million undocumented in this country. So we're grossly underestimating the unemployment there. And we're grossly underestimating urban youth. Urban youth hustling, trying to put a livelihood together, you know, they're not going to talk to the government either. The Labor Department says, well, we turn over the number of people, a small part of which the 50,000 to 60,000 every month, so we get fresh people in, you know. But I don't know what their formula is for that and how accurate it is. In any event, there's what I call hidden unemployment. You know, you have your U3 official full-time unemployment rate, 4.4. You have the U6. Grossly underestimated, discouraged, and missing labor force, and not even counting labor force participation crash going on and where those people are. But you have what I call hidden unemployment, and that is the underground economy, which has been growing, and therefore employment and unemployment in the underground economy is growing. And you have people going on Social Security disability since 2008-09, you know, because unemployment insurance is not very much and it's not very reliable. If you can somehow go on Social Security disability, you've got a guaranteed, so long as you're disabled, a guaranteed compensation check, you see. And a lot of people from the 2008-09 crash went on disability. You know, those numbers ballooned 1 to 2 million people. You know, otherwise they would be unemployed, most of them in the unemployment ranks, and we'd have 1 to 2 million more unemployed. And, of course, when you have an increase in the incarceration rate, those people aren't considered in the labor force, therefore you don't have an estimate for unemployment for them. It reduces the unemployment rate. You know, just take them out of the labor force altogether. That's the same thing as the 9.6 million people aren't even considered into the labor force. All right, 6 million people incarcerated in the U.S. I believe that's the number. Highest percentage per population anywhere in the world. Yes, the U.S. Okay. And underground economy, itinerants and docks and so forth. This is all hidden unemployment. So the unemployment rate, official U3 is 4.4. When you throw in the underemployment, part-time, tech and so forth, it's temp rather, it's 8.6 of 160 million. And that's underestimated, as I said. But when you throw in the hidden unemployment, you know, there's at least a 12% unemployment rate. I estimate 12%. That's a lot of people. Right? You have 12% of 160 million, right? What do you got? You got almost 20 million people, 15 to 20 million people unemployed or underemployed in this country 10 years after the so-called Great Recession ended. Okay. Not a happy picture here for labor. You know, a lot of people and big changes in the labor markets that are undermining jobs and creating less secure, more tenuous jobs. You know, the latest thing is you've got retail, and all those, which transformed since the 80s into full-time to part-time temp work and therefore lower pay, as retail companies were cutting costs and fattening their profit margins. Not just a part-time temp, but now you've got the Amazon effect, right, where e-commerce and everything is just driving these retail companies, at least big box companies, you know, like Penny's and Macy's and Sears and others, they're out of business. Next recession, they're going to be gone, and a lot of these shopping centers are going to have big ad signs, right? So that's an effect, the labor market effect going on. I talked about unpaid interns. Of course, the Uber effect, the gig effect, that's a big problem going on. Labor markets are in major, major flux. And the net result for the working class is stagnation or worse for wages, you see, and compensation. Right. So let's turn to wages. Right. Here again, government data, you've got to understand the government data. By the way, let me back up just one step, one more comment on jobs here. This is really the telling statistic, I think. If you look at November 2007, the last month before the recession began, in December 2007, if you look at the civilian labor force, it was 153.8 million. By August 2017, it was 160.5 million. Okay. That's about 700,000 jobs per year. Right? We're looking at about 7 million, and we're looking at a 10-year period. So we're looking at about 700,000 jobs created per year. That's only 58,000 jobs per month. That's the record, or the fact, for the last decade. The U.S. economy, since the last peak, and, you know, assuming this is a peak in the cycle, has created 58,000 jobs per month. Not very many, you see. Not very many. That's the labor force, right? About the same percentage of those employed and unemployed as in December 2007. 58,000, 60,000 jobs. And, of course, they've been hyping this 250,000 jobs per month over the past year. And now they're, in the latest report today, they're downsizing that estimate. They expected, economists expected another 250,000 here this past week. And, of course, they got 156,000. That's it. Right, and they downward revised the previous 2 months by 41,000. So the last 3 months, it's 185,000 jobs. Well, in 2014, they were creating jobs at 250,000 a month. 2015, it declined to 226, and now it's down to 185. Well, the trend is slower and slower job creation. And remember, these jobs being created are these low-quality jobs, low-paid jobs, jobs without benefits. All right. Well, let's look at wages now. There's two ways of looking at it. One is, well, more than two ways, we can slice and dice this thing. Average private earnings. It was pay per hour averages. And, that means those at the top end may be getting more, and those at the bottom much less, so the average is in between. It's not median, it's average. All right, back in 2007, November, $17.64. $17.64. Today, $26.39, average hourly private earnings. Okay, so So that's like 90 cents an hour on average per year over the last 10 years. 90 cents per hour each year, a raise. For those in the middle, it's much less, of course, because all this is skewed to the high end. And those below the median, of course, aren't getting much and may actually be going backwards. If there's 2,080 hours in an average full-time year, if you're working 40 hours a year, and very few are actually working 40 hours per year, you know, just figure out 90 cents per 2,000 per year, and that will give you the amount of raise you got per year. Well, most of the people are, well, not most, but almost close to half now. I would say there's probably out of 160 million labor force, we're looking at probably at least 60 million or more who are part-time, temp, gig, unemployed, etc. All right. So not very much in terms of hourly. Hourly, 90 cents per hour. If you work a 40-hour work week, you're getting a $36 raise. You've got a $36 raise per year in your paycheck, weekly paycheck. Okay. Another way to look at it is average weekly earnings. Now, what is that? How's that different than hourly earnings? Hourly is your pay per hour. Weekly earnings is your pay per hour times the number of hours you worked that week. In recent years, most of the gain, if there were any, is, was the increase in weekly hours worked. Right? You know, that number has increased to $31 per week per year, right? About $300 over the course of the 10-year period per week. And that's averages again, right? Averages. A subset of all of this is the true working class figure, if you want to reduce it, according to a non-supervisory production and service workers. That's the figure for the working class, and it's less for all of this. Okay. You know, the wages have not been very, very significant, especially if you instead of looking at averages, if you look at, a median or below. The working class has been at best marking time. No gains of any consequence in the last 10 years. Last 10 years. Okay. This lack of wage increases, real wage increases, you know, they say it's a 2.5% increase the past year. Well, that's mostly going to top 10% of the workforce. You know, people in tech and professionals and so forth. It's not going to the vast majority. And, of course, you have to reduce that by inflation. And the inflation rate is somewhere between 1 and 1.5%, whether you look at the CPI or the PCE inflation indicator. Okay, so, you know, it's less than 2.5% when you at the median and when you reduce inflation. And actually, you see, the inflation rate for workers is even greater than the 1 to 1.4%. Well, why is it greater? Because they pay a larger part of their income for housing. You know, rents, which have been going up, for medical care, which have been going up, education, that's been going up, taxes, et cetera, they pay a larger percent. So their inflation rate is higher than the 1 to 1.4%. And if that's true, then their real wage increase is even less than the 2.5%. Okay. So if you look at the working class, the numbers are even harsher than they are indicated. Policymakers can't figure out why there's no real wage increases going on, right? They can't figure out why inflation rate has been declining in the U.S., particularly this year, you see, from a year earlier. We're down to, in the U.S., an inflation rate over the last 3 months or 6 months, or whatever you want to look at, close to 1%, right? Which is well below the target of 2%. You know, we've been talking previous weeks about the Fed, right, Federal Reserve, and its target of 2% that it never makes, and none of the central banks around the world have attained the 2% target. In other words, prices are stagnating. Well, prices are stagnating because there's not much wage demand going on, not much wage creation going on. Okay, so there is consumption. Well, the consumption's being financed by debt. You know, people are borrowing more in order to maintain their standard of living because they're not getting wage increases or they're getting these part-time, temp, low-quality jobs. Or they're financing their consumption by drawing out from their savings. The savings rate is down to about 3% in the U.S. So people are living off their assets, you might say, and borrowing. And borrowing simply means you're going to have less wages to spend in the future because you're going to have to pay interest on whatever you borrow. You know, you're spending your future income. That's what interest is all about. And capitalists love this transformation, you know, in debt the households and working class and by getting them to pay their future wages back in the present, you see. That's what interest rates are all about. And interest rates, of course, are going up, right? You know, policymakers just can't figure out, whoa, gee, why don't we only have a 1%, you know, and that's true everywhere. I deal and address this particular issue in my book that's just out, Central Bankers at the End of Their Rope, right? Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression, which is available on Amazon now, as well as my blog, jackrasmus.com. Or my website that you can get to from my blog. Anyway, it's very important because, as I've argued and have articles now on my blog, how central banks are the major source of income inequality in this country. You see, income inequality and these trends that we're all aware of is only partly response due to the collapse of wages and no wage gain. Yes, that creates the gap between wage earners and non-wage earners, or the latter meaning capital income recipients, right? Profits, interest, you know, dividends, etc., rents, stock buybacks, so forth. That's how the top 5% make their income. It's called capital incomes. If capital incomes accelerate faster than wages, it grow, you're going to have a growing income inequality shifting towards the top end. Of course, it's worse, it's exacerbated when at the same time you don't have wages growing or wages in retreat. Then it's even doubly. But most of the reason for the income inequality is the capital incomes, the expansion of capital, accelerating expansion of capital incomes. The reason for which I talked about in my prior book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, and how we have this global financialization going on and a turn to financial investments and assets by the wealthiest, which accelerate, you know, their total incomes. You know, look at the stock and bond markets and so forth, foreign exchange markets, derivatives, all that, right? They're just raking it in hand over fist, and the rest of us are stagnating or are going backwards. Well, that creates this huge income inequality, and it's the central banks, like the Federal Reserve, that are playing a major, major role in facilitating the growth of capital incomes. Well, I'm not going to go over that whole argument. We've talked about it before, but if you want to check out the blog, jackrasmus.com, The article that I wrote just got published in Z Magazine, Central Banks as the Engines of Economic Income Inequality and Financial Crisis. Okay. So we got this phenomenon, you know, they just don't understand why prices aren't rising. They're slowing, the rate of growth is slowing. Well, the real reason is there's no real wage growth. You know, people don't have the incomes to demand the goods and services. You know, if you had wage growth, you would have even greater demand and prices would rise for goods and services. But they're not. And they're, you know, working class is marking time pretty much economically by dipping into their savings, reducing their savings rates, and also at the same time taking on more and more household debt of various kinds. The New York Fed reported, you know, the household debt is in the U.S. has not really grown, been reduced, from the last crisis. Pretty much the same, and it's rising, as we know, mostly for credit cards and student loans, auto loans, and so forth. Okay, so the wage picture is stagnation at best, right? Job picture, crummy jobs, and questionable numbers here on the part of government data and statistics, and that even those questionable data are now beginning to soften. Okay, so what about benefits? What about benefits? Well, you know, we have about half of the labor force receives some kind of benefit in terms of employer-provided health insurance, right? But the employers have been chipping away at that. They've eliminated, most of the big corporations eliminated retirees' health benefits that they pay for. And that's gone pretty much, and they reduce coverage for dependents, or maybe only one dependent instead of the whole family, or maybe no dependents. You know, so you've got employer provided health insurance for half of the workforce, but it's less coverage than it was. Or if you want to maintain the coverage, they raise the share cost that the worker has to pay. You know, you pay higher deductibles and co-pays and so forth. Or you agree to less coverage in order to keep your contribution about the same. There's lots of ways that they move the money around, you see, and reduce and or shift the cost, even for employer-provided health insurance. And then, of course, what about pensions? Well, ever since Ronald Reagan, they've been destroying real pensions, defined benefit pensions. Only the public sector really has that left, or managers, you know. Senior managers have several pension plans, not 401ks. I mean, real pension plans, compensation pension plans, like they used to, you know, so much per year per service kind of a thing. Deferred income, they call it. They haven't cut it for themselves. They actually added two and three. If you're a senior manager in a company, you have like three pensions, right? Not just a 401k, if you want to put it in. 401ks for the peons, you see. And what they've done, employers have destroyed real pensions and given people 401ks in which the company may make a contribution but may not, or may suspend it whenever they want, and so forth. And usually you have to invest in the company stock, and when that's not doing well, you know, good luck on your investment. 401ks are pretty much a privatization of real pensions. That's what 401ks are. And, of course, ACA, Obamacare, is a privatization of the health care coverage, right? As more and more employers have retreated from providing health insurance for their workers, particularly small and medium companies. You know, we've had 50 million plus uninsured ever since Bill Clinton, and actually more than that. And the solution has been to provide some kind of privatization. And that's what health maintenance organizations were about under Clinton, and then, of course, we got under George Bush, and we got health savings accounts, and now ACA under Obama, which is the inheritor of this looking for a formula for privatization. The good thing about ACA, of course, is that it also increased by major amounts Medicaid, the poor, the coverage of the poor under Medicaid. And that's why the Republicans and Trump, you know, are just, you know, choking on that and want to cut that out in the ACA. They're having some problems doing that, but that's really what they want to go after, you see. You've got to cut that $800 billion out of Medicaid, and that way you can cut the taxes on the 1% and medical devices and other companies with mandates that they have to pay. It's really getting rid of the taxes on the rich. That's what they're attacking, and the way they pay for it is to get rid of Medicaid. Okay, so the big benefits of of paid health insurance and paid pensions have really been gutted. That's been going on for decades, and it's still continuing here. Pretty soon, there won't be any defined benefit plans because now, they primarily only exist in the public sector, state and local governments, and they're going after that right now. Taxes, well, we started talking about taxes. That reduces your real wages, right? It's not just inflation. It's not just interest rates. It's not just stagnation and nominal wages and hours of work. After you get all that, you pay more in taxes, you see. And in order to enable more tax cuts for wealthy and their corporations, you've got to raise taxes to some extent elsewhere. That's coming in this new tax bill that's around the corner here that's going to happen. Trump desperately needs something, and the Republicans in Congress, Ryan McConnell, they need something. So now all the focus is on a tax bill here. And what are they going to do? They're going to cut taxes on corporations and wealthy from the 35% to 15%. That's what Trump said this past week. We're going to cut it to 15% from 35%. Now, that's the nominal rate. That's not what they actually pay. They actually pay, multinational corporations actually pay globally somewhere between 15 and 18%. Effective tax rate. Well, but if you reduce the U.S. tax rate from 35, the nominal, to 15, that effective actual tax is going to fall below 10%. Well, how are they going to pay for that without ballooning the deficit? Well, they're going to go after the working class, the middle class. They're going to eliminate deductions. The big targeted is the deduction for paying state and local taxes and maybe mortgages. Deduction, interest deduction, but not likely that. Almost certainly state deductions, right? So watch that. That's another way, after they pay workers less and less, they come and take back part of what they paid less and less. What's the condition of the unions? Not very good. The private sector is barely 6% unionized. Hardly exists. Unions are just a shell of what they were. And as a result, they can't get the wage increases that they used to. Differential, what was it called? The union wage differential. Unions, 20-25% more higher wages than same occupations, same industry, non-union. Well, unions, as they decline, that wage differential declines. And by the way, that also contributes to the fact that wages aren't growing or declining, right? Wage compression is going on everywhere, right? Because of this part-time temp contract, will be called contingent part-time, or due to e-commerce or the effect of Amazons and so forth, Ubers and the gig economy, automation, replacing jobs with capital machinery, so forth, free trade, reduces the export-import differential, offshoring of jobs, deunionization, benefit privatization, minimum wage. They don't raise the minimum wage. In fact, I read that, where was it? Maybe it was Illinois or someplace, that they're retracting a minimum wage increase that they had paid, right? Reversing it now, right? And then you bring in all the H-1B and L-1-2 and EB-5 visa. Foreign workers take jobs. Productivity is collapsing, and that raises what's called unit labor cost, and businesses take it out on wage increases as a result, right? Wage theft going on, payday loans, unpaid internships, et cetera, right? All these are trends that are reducing wages. And we used to have unions that were strong enough to prevent this, you see. There's a very high correlation between the destruction, decline of unions, and the rise of all these ways that businesses come up with for skimming and squeezing workers and wages. As unions decline in effectiveness, I mean, we, when unions were strong, we didn't have all this part-time temp work because the unions prevented it. And other offenses going on now against labor, and most notably changing the overtime pay rules. Now fewer people will be able to get overtime pay. They'll have to work, and they'll be on salary. Yeah, that's being driven right now by the administration. As I said, rollback of minimum wages, rollback meaning reducing, not even raising minimum wage, but reducing it some places. Unions are under particular attack. New offenses at the state level called the right to work, which is a euphemism for deunionization. Passing state laws that say people, even if you have a union at a company, you don't have to join it. It used to be right to work. Unions could still negotiate what's called an agency fee. In other words, if you benefit from the union contract, you should pay something for the cost of bargaining and so forth. Well, they're attacking that now. In other words, eliminating the agency shop, and as they call that term. And at the same time, not just right to work movements by Koch brothers and others at the state level, but now the new attack is on dues deduction, you see. That's another term in a contract, union contract, where the employer checks off the dues and allows it to the union. Well, now if you make a dues checkoff illegal, as they're trying in Texas, that means the union representatives, instead of handling grievances and problems, have to run around and collect dues from people, you know, on the job, at home, and so forth. And, of course, that irks people. So that's another big offensive against unions. And, of course, we know the political offensive. The Democratic Party has fallen terribly, failed terribly to support union workers. And that's the topic of another day. Okay, this is Alternative Visions, and that's my take, dismal maybe, on the state of working class in this Labor Day 2017.